This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Battles are being fought in Mosul, Iraq, and Raqqa, Syria against the Islamic State, or ISIS. The U.S. has, first under Barack Obama and now under Donald Trump, resorted to little more than strategic bombing of the organization's strongholds. But all that has happened over several years is that ISIS is growing in size and the amount of territory it controls. And individuals, seemingly inspired by the group's methods and ideology, have taken to small-scale attacks on civilians in Western nations. But there is no end in sight. How did it get to this, and is there a path out of it? My guest is Mark Pilisak. He is a professor emeritus at the University of California. He's also on the faculty at the San Francisco-based Saybrook Graduate School and Research Center, where he has taught extensively on conflict resolution, globalization, ecological psychology, and sustainability. He's the author of The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War? And he recently wrote a paper entitled Engaging the ISIS Threat, Time for Method Yet Untried. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So first, when we think about how did we get here, for those people who've been following the U.S. engagement and war in Iraq and its most recent engagement in Syria, it doesn't seem to be that extraordinary or that mysterious as to why we got here. But let's just reiterate it, because we hear politicians and members of the public sort of wonder out loud, why do they hate us? What drives ISIS? How do you sort of summarize their ideology and their view of the United States?
Well, Sonali, I'd like to start by looking at two conceptions of ISIS. One is the concept of a group that controls resources, that acts or tries to act as a state to gain recognition for itself. And as such, that is considered a player in international relations and a player that the West wants to eliminate. The other concept of ISIS, which is perhaps more important, is a widespread belief within the Middle East, across many countries, and beyond that. And it's a concept that says that the US and the neoliberal establishment has for years and years acted to undermine governments in the Middle East, to usurp the resources of the Middle East, to insist that that puppet regimes there are responsive to the neoliberal consensus. We have disrespected their culture and their religion, and we've tortured their people in warfare. It becomes easy for them to have a large pool of people from whom to draw. And the very activities that go into the military opposition to the ISIS as an organized entity increase the ability of them to draw recruits. And we get stuck in an endless cycle of lone wolf activities, striking at terror, and an excuse for us to increase the military involvement, thereby to make the matter worse.
Now, you have said that it's important to understand what's happening in these areas through networks rather than through the actions of individuals. What do you mean by that? Because, of course, politicians in the United States want to point to, you know, it used to be Osama bin Laden of Al-Qaeda was the bogeyman. Now it's Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and there's a dependence on individual actions. But why is it important for us to look at this through how networks are functioning?
I'm going to read a little, very short piece from my book. This is the network of one individual, but it's exemplary of how people in policy are interconnected. This was Gordon England, who was a secretary under George Bush, Secretary of the Navy. In this position, he led the Navy and Marine Corps, was responsible for more than 800,000 military and civilian personnel, with an annual budget of more than $420 billion. He joined Homeland Security. He was executive vice president for General Dynamics Corporation, which was responsible for two major corporate sectors, information systems and technology, and international contracting. Previously, he served as an executive vice president of the Combat Systems Group, president of General Dynamics Fort Worth Aircraft Company, later Lockheed, who was president of General Dynamics Land Systems Company, the principal of mergers and acquisitions, and a consulting company. Now, these corporate connections are common, but corporations are also connected to one another. One can track the board membership of England's General Dynamics Board, which includes a number of retired generals, admirals, directors of major financial firms, J.P. Morgan Chase, LLC Investment Banking. They're connected to the food industry, Sara Lee, to pharmaceuticals, Schering Plough. The web goes even further. With higher level government and corporate officials, one finds multiple links to financial institutions and to major trade organizations such as Petroleum Institute and Pharma.
So Mark, let me just interrupt you there. So essentially you're making the case, it sounds like, that these are networks that have a widespread influence around the world, and they also, as such, have an influence in how Americans think about the threat from ISIS, right?
From the point of view of those people who are in official positions to make the decisions about our involvement in the Middle East conflict, from their perspective, they are part of a world that sees the relevant players as those who are the official authorities within states. They move in and out through a revolving door themselves to be part of the U.S. government, but they also are part of a international network, and now with high-level or high-powered means of investigation, we have studies that show that the major transnational corporations are interconnected through a network that boils down to approximately 40 players who have the ability not to make every decision, but to constrain the areas of decisions that are being made.
Let's talk about what you discuss in your paper, Engaging the ISIS Threat, Time for Method Yet Untried. I mean, we have a, we have this idea through our media reports that ISIS is this death cult. They are wholly, there's an organization that you just can't reason with. They have a very narrow focus and all they want to do is kill people. However, you say in your paper, the one thing that we haven't done is sit down and try to talk to ISIS. Now, how would that work when you have an organization that is quite determined to, take life and doesn't seem to care very much about taking life?
There's no doubt that there is an organizational structure to ISIS, and there is no doubt that there is leadership within ISIS that is looking to find those places where it can actually fight against a very superior military establishment. There's also no question that within that group, which is now quite segmented, actually, it's not a united group anymore, that there are branches of it that are in opposition to Al-Qaeda. But within that group, there are certain believers that they are in a world struggle, and that it is okay that their own survival depends upon their being able to weaken the West, and they are willing to do this by any means possible. So the idea that they can recruit an individual who will give their lives to create a terrorist attack works very well for them, because those attacks, however rare and however small in nature to the threats that ordinary people face, they can always be elaborated and inflict terror and bring out a response from the West that will help them to recruit membership.
So the West plays into their hands, is what you're saying, constantly.
Right. And so you ask about, well, how does one contact or make any kind of indentation and the effects of people with such a mindset. And I want to respond in two ways. One is that we have to look at the question of how do we make an indentation into the mindset of those who will exploit that area militarily, destroy major portions of it, use excuses like that we are benefiting and protecting against their own actions in their own countries. How do we get into our own mindset to be able to view this as not a war of ultimate decisions between the militant Islamic terrorists and the rest of the so-called reasonable world, but rather to look at this as an opportunity for people who are not part of that organized decision structure to be able to speak to each other? And one of the things that may be critical in doing this is to be able to acknowledge what the past has been and the responsibility of the West. There is a whole area of study in conflict resolution which is at least as intricate and well-founded as the study of military intervention, and it's often ignored. We have examples of groups that go into high-level conflict zones that are tribally divided and are able to establish peace caravans to work with the people within them. We have examples like the Center for Creative Nonviolence that go into combat zones in Afghanistan and in the Middle East and talk to people and intervene in areas where there is direct conflict. And we have examples of where our local participation is actually standing up for the cessation of violence. One great example came out recently in the Win Without War group. They're saying that we can combat this at a level that's different from trying directly to persuade political leaders at the highest level, but to go up to the local level and to say that the budget that is going into this, to go to our city councils, say that the budget is going into this is wasted, that it is not securing security, and that it is needed for things that are being drained from local communities.
So let's talk about what the, you know, how realistic this is. And also maybe if you can give us some examples in other places where this method of nonviolent diplomacy has worked against a group that commits extremely violent acts. I mean, you know, you might get laughed at if you suggest talking to ISIS as a viable strategy to people in the government, but can you point to any historical examples of where it has been tried and has found to have worked?
Well, one example is in Kenya. In Kenya, we were faced with, again, economically distressed at tribally identified entities where the violence was almost uncontrollable. And what Mediators Without Borders was able to do was to establish a group which, instead of teaching them how to be peaceful, taking the lead from tribal leaders to establish caravans that would go from place to place and establish and help to establish what was the common need for peace and for development in the area. And the tests have shown that, in fact, they've gone a very long way to reducing the intertribal violence, which before that had really no set of constraints. One of the things that happens is that we don't hear about the victories of these idealistic activities of progressive groups because the media control does not say that this particular village now has recruited fewer ISIS people, or that this particular village gotten a group together with pro-Assad and anti-Assad factions. And yet these things are occurring. It's part of our idea, not to be afraid of being laughed at, but to make sure that these things become reasonably spoken about and that they provide an opportunity for people who are not part of the established military structure to be able to speak in ways that are reasonable to lowering the intensity of conflict and establishing some hope for a Middle East in which there is a modicum of respect for all people.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people find out more about your work? Can you give out your website?
And people can definitely contact me directly. The email address is just mpilisuk, P-I-L-I-S-U-K, at saybrook.edu.
And we'll post that on our site later today. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, Sonali, and good luck.
My guest is Mark Pilisuk, a professor emeritus at the University of California. He's on the faculty at the San Francisco-based Saybrook Graduate School and Research Center, where he's taught extensively on conflict resolution, globalization, and more. He's the author of The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War? And he recently wrote a paper entitled Engaging the ISIS Threat, Time for a Method Yet Untried. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can also sign up for our daily newsletter. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.